In the gritty underbelly of literary horror, few works have sparked as much controversy as Aaron Beauregard's Yellow. This unflinching exploration of transformation through trauma has developed a cult following among extreme horror enthusiasts, with readers praising its unapologetic approach to violence as a mechanism for character evolution. The book's title, a reference to cowardice, serves as both accusation and challenge to its protagonist. What begins as a tale of victimization evolves into a blood-soaked journey of metamorphosis that asks uncomfortable questions about the nature of courage, vengeance, and human breaking points. Though certainly not for the faint of heart, Yellow has been cited by horror luminaries like Jack Ketchum as exemplifying the genre's capacity to explore human darkness without moral restraint. The novel's unflinching brutality serves as a mirror reflecting society's most disturbing impulses, forcing readers to confront the uncomfortable truth that perhaps the greatest horror lies not in supernatural monsters, but in the darkness lurking within ordinary people pushed beyond their limits. Oliver Fitch's existence is defined by fear. As the owner of a convenience store in a dangerous neighborhood, he faces daily intimidation from the criminal element that surrounds him. This reality becomes painfully clear when Angel Rodriguez, a violent local thug, threatens both Oliver and his wife Lydia simply because Oliver forgot Angel's cigarette brand. The encounter is chilling in its casual menace. Angel pulls a knife and threatens to carve his cigarette preference into either Oliver or Lydia's flesh before finally leaving with two packs of Newport shorts. This incident serves as a microcosm of Oliver's entire life, a man paralyzed by fear, unable to protect himself or those he loves. The aftermath reveals the deep fractures in Oliver and Lydia's marriage. She bitterly criticizes his cowardice, blaming him for trapping them in this dangerous neighborhood by purchasing the stop-and-go in the first place. Yellow, she calls him, a cutting reference to his cowardice that will echo throughout the narrative. Their marriage crumbles further under the constant strain of fear and humiliation. Oliver has become desensitized to Lydia's verbal attacks, letting them wash over him while secretly harboring growing resentment. The store that was meant to be their ticket to independence has instead become their prison, with Oliver cast in the role of ineffectual warden, unable to maintain order or safety. The neighborhood itself functions almost as a character, a malevolent force that seems to feed on weakness. Every interaction reinforces Oliver's powerlessness, from the gang members who loiter outside this store to the corrupt police who are supposed to protect him. In this environment, showing fear is like bleeding in shark-infested waters. It only attracts more predators. What makes Oliver's situation particularly tragic is his self-awareness. He recognizes his own crippling lack of confidence as a cruel irony given the dangerous environment he's trapped in. He knows he should stand up for himself, but years of conditioning have rendered him incapable of confrontation. This internal conflict, knowing what he should do but being unable to do it, creates a pressure cooker of repressed rage and shame that will eventually transform him in ways neither he nor the reader could anticipate. The corruption that permeates Oliver's world extends to those sworn to protect it. This becomes evident when Officer Logan Thomas enters Oliver's store, casually taking a donut and coffee without paying, a small theft that symbolizes the larger abuses of power that define his character. When Ramon Cruz, one of Oliver's few friendly customers, calls out the officer's theft, Thomas immediately resorts to racial slurs and intimidation, resting his hand on his holstered gun in a clear threat. Ramon's response is telling. He compares the corrupt cop to the gang members gathering outside, saying Thomas is just another criminal. This blurring of lines between law enforcement and criminals is not merely philosophical, it's literal. Oliver recalls witnessing Thomas shoot a mentally ill junkie 7 times before planting a knife on the body to justify the killing. The officer has a reputation for trigger-happy violence, with rumors circulating that he receives kickbacks from funeral homes for the bodies he creates. Once again, Oliver freezes in fear during this confrontation, unable to stand up for himself or his customer. His paralysis in the face of injustice becomes a recurring motif, highlighting how systems of power maintain themselves through intimidation. Those who should protect the vulnerable instead prey upon them, creating a cycle of abuse that seems impossible to break. The interaction between Thomas and Ramon illustrates the racial dynamics at play in this environment. Ramon, as a Hispanic man, faces additional threats and prejudice from authorities, yet paradoxically shows more courage than Oliver in standing up to injustice. This courage will cost Ramon dearly later in the story, as those who speak truth to power in this world rarely go unpunished. The scene establishes a crucial element to the story's moral landscape. In Oliver's world, there are no heroes coming to save the day. The traditional protectors, police, are just as dangerous as the criminals, leaving ordinary citizens to fend for themselves in a landscape where might makes right and weakness invites exploitation. This absence of justice creates the conditions for Oliver's eventual transformation from victim to vigilante. When the system fails completely, individuals may feel compelled to create their own form of justice, however twisted it might become. The novel introduces us to the true monsters lurking in Oliver's neighborhood. Not supernatural creatures, but human predators who have embraced their darkest impulses. Damian Sanchez emerges as the primary antagonist, a heavily tattooed gang leader covered in satanic imagery, including implanted horns and a branded crucifix. We first encounter him cleaning blood from his brass knuckles after murdering a woman named Gina Spain for talking to police. His casual attitude toward extreme violence, ordering his female companions to dispose of her mutilated body while adding another tally mark tattoo to his collection, establishes him as a figure who has completely abandoned conventional morality. Meanwhile, we meet Levi Ballard as Angel picks him up from prison. Their relationship reveals the complex bonds formed in criminal organizations. Levi had saved Angel from being raped and killed years earlier, taking him under his wing and grooming him to become part of Damien's criminal empire. Upon reunion, Levi acknowledges Angel's success in the gang, but maintains emotional distance, suggesting a relationship built on power rather than genuine affection. Angel's welcome home gift for Levi, ski masks, a gun, and alcohol, foreshadows the violence to come. The narrative hints at Levi's sexual predilections, noting that he prefers to take rather than get sexual gratification, a disturbing indication of his predatory nature that will soon be directed at Oliver and Lydia. These characters represent the apex predators in Oliver's ecosystem, men who have embraced violence not just as a means to an end, but as a way of life. They operate according to their own twisted code, where strength and brutality determine status. Their existence creates a Darwinian environment where the weak are victimized simply because they can be, with no higher purpose or justification needed. What makes these characters particularly terrifying is their complete lack of empathy or restraint. They are not conflicted about their actions or driven by necessity. They take pleasure in domination and pain. This establishes the stakes for Oliver's journey. In a world populated by such predators, can a yellow man find the courage to stand up for himself? And if he does, can he avoid becoming the very monster he's fighting against? As night falls, Angel and Levi don ski masks in the alley behind the Stop and Go, climbing to the second floor via a rusty fire escape. Their target, Oliver and Lydia's apartment. What follows is one of the most disturbing sequences in contemporary horror literature, a home invasion that transforms the victims in ways that can never be undone. The assault begins with Angel slapping Oliver awake while Levi brutally attacks Lydia. The violence quickly escalates to sexual assault, with both Oliver and Lydia subjected to degradation designed not just to harm their bodies, but to destroy their sense of self. When Oliver attempts to protest, he's further victimized, forced to taste his wife's fluids before vomiting helplessly. The ultimate humiliation comes when Angel reveals his identity by removing his mask. He's the same man who threatened them at the store earlier, connecting this violence directly to Oliver's previous failure to stand up for himself. The assault represents a complete violation of their home, their bodies, and their dignity. As Oliver loses consciousness, he begins fantasizing about violent revenge, the first indication that something fundamental has shifted within him. The seeds of his transformation are planted in this moment of extreme trauma. What makes this scene particularly disturbing is not just the graphic violence, but the psychological dimensions of the assault. Lydia experiences unwanted physical responses during her rape, adding a layer of shame and self-loathing to her trauma. Oliver is forced to witness his wife's violation before experiencing his own, a deliberate strategy by the attackers to maximize the psychological damage. The power dynamics established earlier in the story, Oliver's cowardice, Lydia's resentment, their mutual entrapment in a dangerous environment, are exploited and amplified through this violence. The assault serves as the catalyst for everything that follows. It's the moment when Oliver's world is irreparably shattered, forcing him to either find strength he never knew he possessed or be destroyed completely. The brutality of this scene establishes the stakes for Oliver's subsequent transformation. After experiencing such extreme violation, conventional morality and social constraints begin to lose their hold. When the social contract has been so thoroughly broken, what obligation does the victim have to continue honoring its terms? The aftermath of the assault reveals layers of betrayal that compound Oliver's trauma. In the hospital, Detective Max Treadwell stands by Oliver's heavily stitched face, delivering devastating news. Both he and Lydia were beaten, cut, and raped during the attack. Outside the door, officers Thomas and Price laugh callously, highlighting the indifference of the supposed protectors. The final revelation proves most shattering. The attackers forced Lydia at gunpoint to sodomize Oliver with a knife and pour bleach inside him. Though Treadwell presents this as something Lydia was forced to do, Oliver remembers seeing her looking almost pleased during his violation, suggesting a horrifying possibility that some part of Lydia welcomed his humiliation after years of resenting his weakness. When Treadwell gently questions Oliver about the attacker's identities, Oliver refuses to name Angel Rodriguez. This decision stems not from courage or principle, but from fear of the consequences and suspicion of police corruption. The system designed to protect him has failed so completely that Oliver can't even trust it to deliver justice for the most heinous crime imaginable. Upon his release from the hospital, Oliver returns home to discover Lydia hanging from the ceiling fan by an extension cord, her decomposing body swarming with flies and maggots. His emotional response reveals the complexity of their relationship. Relief at avoiding confrontation about her apparent enjoyment during his violation, anger at her constant belittlement throughout their marriage, and panic, realizing she likely died before paying their mortgage. In his distress, Oliver begins a deranged, one-sided argument with her corpse, imagining her taunting him about his weakness. This moment marks the beginning of his psychological fracture. Unable to process his trauma in healthy ways, Oliver begins creating an alternate reality where Lydia becomes both tormentor and confidant. His declaration that, unlike her, he won't take the easy way out establishes his new mission: brutal revenge against those who wronged them. The layers of betrayal Oliver experiences, from his attackers, from the police, from society's failure to protect him, and potentially from his own wife, create a perfect storm that shatters his previous identity. With nothing left to lose and no faith in conventional justice, Oliver begins his metamorphosis from victim to avenger. The disturbing smile that crosses his face as he decides Lydia's corpse will hang around to witness his vengeance signals that something fundamental has broken within him. The old Oliver is dead, replaced by someone capable of horrors previously unimaginable. Oliver's transformation accelerates as he confronts the institutions that have failed him. His visit to Landmark Credit Union reveals the callous indifference of financial systems to human suffering. Branch manager Evelyn Watts, overheard boasting about foreclosures, dismisses Oliver's explanation about missing payments due to hospitalization. She never acknowledges his disfigured face or shows empathy, even when he screams that his wife is dead. The scene perfectly captures how institutional violence often operates, not through direct physical harm, but through policies and procedures that dehumanize those already suffering. Evelyn's refusal to see Oliver as a human being in crisis rather than a delinquent account number represents another form of violation, one sanctioned by society rather than condemned by it. When security drags Oliver out and throws him into a puddle, the humiliation continues. Officer Thomas approaches, backhanding Oliver's scarred face and threatening him. "In a war zone like this, you gotta evolve before you dissolve," he warns, unknowingly providing the philosophical justification for Oliver's emerging vigilantism. Before driving away, Thomas hands Oliver a flyer falsely labeling Ramon as a sex offender, revealing another layer of institutional corruption. This encounter proves pivotal in Oliver's psychological journey. As Thomas drives away, Oliver realizes he's done with crying. The last vestige of his former self falls away. The institutions meant to protect citizens, banking, law enforcement, community safety, have all failed him completely. In their place, Oliver begins constructing his own moral framework, one based on retribution rather than justice. The scene at Ramon's apartment further cements Oliver's new path. Finding the place draped in crime scene tape, he meets Ramon's brother Alejandro, who reveals the dark underbelly of gang life, the code blood in, blood out that keeps people trapped in cycles of violence. This parallel between institutional entrapment and gang entrapment isn't accidental. Both systems create conditions where escape seems impossible and compliance becomes the only option for survival. Oliver's realization that he must become the aggressor rather than waiting for the next attack represents his full embrace of the Darwinian principles governing his environment. If institutions won't protect him, he'll protect himself. If justice isn't available through legitimate channels, he'll create his own version. This logic, compelling yet ultimately destructive, drives his subsequent actions, blurring the line between justified vengeance and sadistic retribution. Oliver's transformation reaches its horrifying conclusion as he captures and tortures Levi, one of his attackers. What follows is a descent into sadism that forces readers to question their allegiance to Oliver as a protagonist. After crushing Levi's legs into pulp with a sledgehammer, Oliver revives him with smelling salts when he passes out from pain, ensuring his victim remains conscious to experience every moment of suffering. The torture escalates to increasingly depraved acts involving Lydia's decomposing corpse, culminating in Oliver forcing Levi to sexually penetrate her decaying body, which has been booby-trapped to mutilate him further. When Levi finally begs for death with his eyes, Oliver grants it by emptying an Uzi into his head and neck. This sequence represents Oliver's complete metamorphosis, from victim to perpetrator, from prey to predator. His reflection afterward is telling. He realizes he's transformed completely, no longer the weak man everyone thought he was, no longer yellow. The title's meaning becomes fully apparent. Oliver has shed his cowardice, but at what cost to his humanity? The transformation continues as Oliver targets Officer Thomas, setting an elaborate trap at Hoffman's funeral home. Discovering Thomas's partnership with funeral director Donald Hoffman, a scheme where Thomas murders minorities while Hoffman provides discount funeral services to their families, Oliver confronts the corrupt officer about framing Ramon with fabricated child abuse charges. After getting his confession, Oliver executes Thomas with a shotgun blast to the head. His vengeance extends to Hoffman, whom he ambushes with a machete, slicing open his abdomen and severing his fingers as he clutches an envelope of cash. Even in death, Hoffman's hands remain clutched around the blood-soaked money, a powerful image of greed persisting beyond life itself. Oliver's next target is Evelyn, the bank employee who denied him compassion. His attack on her is particularly brutal, smashing her eye socket with a tire iron before binding her over her coffee table. When her boyfriend Mark interrupts the attack, Oliver is forced to kill this innocent bystander, crossing a moral line that separates justified vengeance from indiscriminate violence. With each kill, Oliver moves further from the man he once was. His methods become increasingly sadistic. His targets expand beyond those directly responsible for his suffering, and his justifications grow more tenuous. The transformation is complete. The coward has become the monster, raising uncomfortable questions about the nature of justice and the psychological cost of trauma. As Oliver's bloody quest continues, the novel reveals even darker aspects of the criminal underworld. He discovers a human trafficking operation run by Captain Mooney and Lieutenant Briscoe, corrupt officers who force Asian women to fight to the death for their sexual gratification. The scene is nightmarish. Mooney receives oral sex from a captive while holding a gun to her head as Briscoe forces another girl to suffocate her opponent. Oliver ambushes the officers, freeing their victims and turning the tables by forcing the corrupt policemen to experience the same helplessness they inflicted on others. When asked what should happen to them, a victim named Mosley decisively answers, "They will fight." The freed women surround the cage with weapons, eager to inflict the same cruelty they've endured. The scene culminates in brutal justice as Briscoe turns on Captain Mooney, killing him with a meat cleaver before Oliver shoots Briscoe in the genitals. The women then repeatedly stab Briscoe until he dies, a collective catharsis for their suffering. Oliver's journey takes him further into this underworld as he boards a massive ship where trafficking victims are transported. There, he confronts the Big Hands, a monstrous kidnapper with unnaturally long fingers who wears a black mask. Despite being attacked by this laughing, black-toothed monster, Oliver manages to kill him and free more victims. The women then repeatedly stab Briscoe until he dies, a collective catharsis for their suffering. Oliver's journey takes him further into this underworld as he boards a massive ship where trafficking victims are transported. There, he confronts the Big Hands, a monstrous kidnapper with unnaturally long fingers who wears a black mask. Despite being attacked by this laughing, black-toothed monster, Oliver manages to kill him and free more victims. These sequences reveal the true extent of corruption in Oliver's world. Not isolated incidents, but systematic exploitation protected by those in power. The horror extends beyond individual predators to entire networks dedicated to human suffering. By dismantling these operations, Oliver achieves something closer to true justice than mere revenge, suggesting that sometimes systems so corrupt require violent intervention when legitimate channels fail completely. Yet even as Oliver frees victims and punishes perpetrators, his methods remain problematic. His violence has become an end in itself rather than a means to justice. The line between righteous vengeance and sadistic pleasure has blurred beyond recognition. Even when his targets deserve punishment, Oliver's excessive brutality raises questions about what he has become in his quest for retribution. Oliver's journey culminates in a confrontation with Damian Sanchez, the satanic gang leader who represents the apex of evil in this world. After calling Detective Treadwell to expose the trafficking operation and police corruption, Oliver prepares to face his final target. However, he's captured by Officer Price and delivered to Damien's ritualistic altar. The scene that unfolds reveals the full extent of Damien's depravity. He performs occult rituals involving human sacrifice, including beheading a crucified boy named Bootsy when Price demands payment. Genocide, Damien's accomplice, tears out Price's throat and they dismember the officer, planning to boil his remains. When Damien leaves to prepare his goats for a ritual, Oliver seizes his opportunity. While Genocide struggles with a malfunctioning heating coil, Oliver cuts the rope holding a massive iron cauldron, which crashes down and crushes her against the heating element. After retrieving keys from her melting body and freeing himself, Oliver prepares for the final confrontation with Damien. Meanwhile, Detective Treadwell surveys the horrific scene at Pike Warehouse, where he discovers photographic evidence confirming the guilt of the corrupt officers. When rookie Detective Sims attempts to burn the evidence to protect the department's reputation, Treadwell stops him forcefully, declaring, "It stops here." This moment represents a small victory for legitimate justice in a world otherwise governed by power and corruption. Oliver's final act of vengeance against Damien, implied rather than explicitly shown, results in him leaving a blood-soaked pile of money at Alejandro's door with a note thanking him for the guns and instructing him to help Ramon. The note concludes with, "I finally made it back to the beach," a reference to the sanctuary Oliver shared with Lydia before their lives unraveled. Severely wounded, Oliver drives frantically toward the ocean with his decomposing wife Lydia seemingly beside him. After crashing into a boulder, he drags her rotting corpse to the shoreline, pushing his intestines back into the gash left by Damien's goat. As they reach the beach, hallucinated Lydia reminisces about how this was their private sanctuary where they felt like the last two people on Earth. In a final moment of delusional tenderness, Oliver kisses her maggot-filled mouth passionately before collapsing into her lap, whispering, "I love you too," as his life ebbs away on the deserted shore. The sun finally emerges after months of rainfall, shining down on their bodies as they remain embraced on the beach for weeks. Eventually, crabs and insects consume their rotting flesh, leaving only stained skeletons basking under the healing sun. As a storm rolls in, powerful waves pull their skeletal remains away, a final release from the horror that defined their lives. The novel's conclusion offers no easy moral lessons or comforting resolution. Oliver's transformation from victim to vigilante to monster raises uncomfortable questions about justice, vengeance, and the psychological impact of trauma. His journey from yellow coward to merciless avenger comes at the cost of his humanity. By the end, he's as monstrous as those he sought to punish, distinguished only by his targets rather than his methods. The cyclical nature of violence permeates the story. Oliver's initial victimization leads to his own violent retribution, which in turn creates new victims, like Mark, Evelyn's innocent boyfriend. Even his final act, leaving money for Alejandro to help Ramon, perpetuates the cycle by funding further violence. The implication is clear. In a world governed by force, violence begets violence in an endless chain. Yet, amidst this bleak outlook, small moments of genuine justice emerge. The freed trafficking victims find catharsis in punishing their tormentors. Detective Treadwell chooses integrity over corruption, declaring, "It stops here," when confronted with evidence of police wrongdoing. These moments suggest that while systemic change may be difficult, individual choices still matter. Oliver's final return to the beach with Lydia's corpse represents his attempt to reclaim something pure from his former life, a memory of connection and peace before violence consumed them both. This bittersweet ending acknowledges that even in the darkest stories, human beings seek meaning and connection, however distorted those impulses might become. As the ocean finally claims their remains, there's a sense of natural order reasserting itself. The water washing away the blood and horror, returning their elements to the cycle of life. This ending offers not redemption, but release from pain, from vengeance, from the burden of existence in a world where justice seems impossible and violence inevitable. Beauregard's unflinching exploration of trauma and retribution leaves readers with difficult questions rather than easy answers. How do we respond to injustice without becoming monsters ourselves? Is vengeance ever truly satisfying, or does it simply perpetuate cycles of violence? And perhaps most disturbingly, how thin is the line between civilization and savagery when systems of justice fail completely?